You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, May 16th, 2025, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. We are live from the second Nauticon, the conference that's not a conference, but it is a conference because it's awesome. I am joined today by Bob Novella.
Hello, everybody. Hello, hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Beautiful White Plains, New York.
And we have a special guest, Adam Russell. Adam, welcome to the SGU.
Hello there.
Adam, you are two things that I love. You're a musician and a big fan of Star Wars. Tell me about that.
Yes, I'm a bass player in a band called Story of the Year. Yep. We've been around for almost 25 years now.
Started when you were five?
I was only five. You should have seen me play bass at five. It was sick. No, I'm aging rapidly.
And are we all?
Sure you are.
My other job, my like paid hobby, is my podcast, Thank the Maker, a Star Wars podcast. Star Wars is like my religion. I say that half, honestly, half just tongue-in-cheek, you know? But Kara was talking earlier about not understanding fandoms, mm-hmm. and a lot of it is like the community, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, if there's one positive thing you could probably pull out of religion, it's community, you mm-hmm. know? So Star Wars, in a lot of ways, is that for me.
What did you think of Andor?
Loved it.
Loved it, right? It
some
awesome.
Of the best Star Wars of all time. But it,
my favorite.
It's also, we've been having this conversation about how the one potential downside is that it's making adult Star Wars fans so happy that a new bar has been set.
Okay.
So now anything that's sort of made for kids.
Yeah.
It seems like it has more potential for getting hate because it's like, if it's not Andor, it's shit. You know,
then maybe they need two brands. They need like Star Wars Kids and Star Wars Adults.
Star Wars
that's
Zero
what
Sugar
was. Yeah. So, what you're looking at on the screen is a very unusual creature. Any of you guys have a guess of what that creature is from? What kind of creature is it?
I just read it off your thing. So.
Okay. So that is a Mosura Fantona. I wrote in my notes a radiodont because that's what it is—a radiodont—and it corrected to radiodont. But it's a radiodont. You may be familiar with Anomalocaris. Does that sound more familiar to you?
Anomalocaris, I love it.
Yeah, so this is related to Anomalocaris. This is from the Burgess Shale. Does that ring any bells?
Yes.
So that's from the Cambrian explosion. It's one of the most important finds. It was the first find that really told us what the Cambrian explosion was. So we're going back 500 plus million years. This is the first time that multicellular life explodes into the fossil record, right? This is when life created hard parts that could fossilize. Then suddenly the fossil record turns on and we're seeing basically every existing phyla plus a few that don't exist anymore were all in existence over a fairly geologically short period of time. We now know from further evidence that there's a long history there. Again, it was just when they started actually fossilizing that creates the illusion in the fossil record that they suddenly appeared. But Anomalocaris is one of those no longer existing phyla, the radiodonts, and that thing was a beast. It was a predator. So this is a newly discovered specimen, very well preserved. These are all in the Burgess Shale, so they're kind of flattened two-dimensionally, between pieces of rock, and then paleontologists have to painstakingly reconstruct them three-dimensionally. But this creature had better three-dimensional detail than older specimens. Also, our techniques are getting better. You know, they can examine fossils with X-rays and CT scans and other things to help reconstruct them three-dimensionally.
How big is it?
It's big. It's it's several feet. It's it has three eyes.
Three.
You can see it's got a third eye in the middle there. It's got these two sort of claw things.
That's cool.
And it does exist.
And it's got a bunch of fins down the side. Kind of looks like wings.
So what would it eat?
It was probably a top predator.
Are they actual eyes, or are they just eye spots?
No, they're eyes.
They're actual, like.
I mean, I think they're fairly primitive eyes, but they're eyes. They're not. I think they're not eye spots. Yeah, from 506 million years ago, this particular fossil, gorgeous fossil. If you don't know about the Burgess Shale, it's worth reading about. Stephen Jay Gould wrote a whole book about it. So, really amazing, amazing fossil discovery. There's another fossil I'm going to talk about really quickly. Anybody recognize this? Any of you guys up here? I know Kara knows what this is.
Archaeopteryx.
It is an Archaeopteryx. Yeah.
That is like the death pose with the neck curled back.
That is the latest Archaeopteryx specimen. Guess how many Kara knows this. How many do you think we have now? How many different specific specimens of Archaeopteryx?
One and a half.
This is number 14.
Yeah, we have a lot. Oh. And they're complete because they're in the like, is it sandstone, limestone?
Yeah, usually in... Yeah.
Lithographica.
Lithographica. Yeah. This is found in China. Interesting how this was obtained. We actually don't know where it came from specifically. It was sold from one private collector to another private collector to another private collector and then to the Chicago Museum. When they bought it... It didn't look like what it looks like now. It was basically completely encased with rock, and just the wings were peeking out.
Oh my God!
So they knew that it was probably an Archaeopteryx, but they thought it was crap. And they're like, "Should we even buy this? This is probably going to be the worst Archaeopteryx specimen in existence."
Got a good deal then.
But you know, it's an Archaeopteryx specimen. So they bought it. Then they spent. It's at 13,000 hours.
What the hell?
Reconstructing it. And
that's a lot.
Well, good on all those collectors not destroying it as it was passed around. I mean, yeah,
it was
a huge problem with private collection.
It was encased.
But that's what I'm saying. Good on them not being like, let me.
They didn't touch it. Yeah, fortunately. Yeah. It turned out to be the single best Archaeopteryx specimen.
Oh, my God. Wow. Why?
I mean, I'm partial to the Berlin specimen, but I hear you.
The Berlin specimen's gorgeous. And I think this is beautiful, too. But it's more complete. It's almost 100% complete. Like, it's an almost 100% complete specimen. And it's not crushed. Yep. So it preserved three-dimensional anatomy better than any other Archaeopteryx specimen. It's the best one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it partly the best one because they had awesome techniques to extract it?
Well, yeah. Yes, partly. It was just a good specimen, but also we benefit from having the good techniques for exposing it and preserving it, and again, CT scanning and doing other kind of examinations.
We were at a museum once, and the guy was working on a whale fossil.
Mm-hmm.
You all saw that? Right?
Nick Pyonson, the Smithsonian.
I remember looking at him working on it through the window, right? Mm-hmm. I was like 2 feet away from him. And there was like the parts that he had already cleared, and then there were the parts that he had not cleared, and they were exactly the same. Same color, same shape and everything, and I'm like... A part of me was like, what the hell's going on here? Because I don't see the difference, and how is anybody seeing the difference?
Because they do it all day, every day.
How does he know when to stop chipping away if it looks exactly the same?
Because
it doesn't look exactly
density.
The same to him.
They're different. Okay. Use techniques that will take away the stone.
You can also
taste
it.
That's why it's so painstaking.
You can taste it.
Yeah. Huh. So one of the things they discovered here was that they suspected Archaeopteryx had this, but they didn't know from any of the previous specimens. So Archaeopteryx is the first bird, meaning that it's the oldest specimen of a dinosaur that was also a bird, right? Birds are dinosaurs. So Archaeopteryx is a dinosaur, but it's also a bird.
What's Proto-Avis that pops to mind?
Yeah, so there are all the other ones
that's
that if they're over the line to bird, they are younger than Archaeopteryx, right? Now, Archaeopteryx probably was not on the line to modern birds. It was because bird-like dinosaurs were radiated madly, right? So there's lots of evolutionary radiations, and it would be very almost impossible to find something that was on the direct line that happened to lead to modern birds. So everything's going to be an offshoot, right? So it is also an offshoot. But
are they sure of that?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
But it is a bird, and it's the oldest bird. Now we have 14 specimens. So one of the things that they found was it has these secondary flight feathers under the primary flight feathers, which all flying birds have. And again, we thought it flew, so it probably had them. So it's interesting that it does. All feathered dinosaurs who didn't fly do not have these feathers.
How big was it?
Secondaries.
It's pretty small.
It's like
a couple feet high or something, 18 inches, 2 feet. This is the smallest specimen.
Oh, really? It's even smaller?
This is the smallest one.
Did they think it was young?
Don't know. The thing is, so right now they're considering every of all 14 as the same genus, Archaeopteryx. But they're probably different species, right? So it may be age, but it may also just be this is a slightly smaller species. Because, you know, they were once found in Germany and China. They're not the same species, probably.
Right.
So anyway, gorgeous specimen. Just really getting a look at it. This is just coming out now.
So cool.
And new information, very, very well preserved.
Aren't they speculating that they think it flew like a chicken? I'm reading that a lot. Yeah, like
it was a poor flyer. It was a poor flyer. Certainly doesn't have the modern adaptations of modern birds. It's like specifically like its sternum. You know how like a bird's sternum is. And they have an anatomy that allows them to do something that's called a wing flip maneuver. That's how they take off from the ground. Archaeopteryx does not have that. Mm-hmm. So it probably would have a lot of trouble and maybe couldn't even take off from the ground. But it had claws that would have allowed it to climb trees. So it probably still was spending a lot of time walking on the ground and probably also could climb trees and then could fly or glide from there.
It's a beautiful intermediary.
Perfect.
It's got like a beak and teeth.
It's got a bony tail, but it has feathers and it flew. It is pretty much as close to halfway between a theropod dinosaur and a bird dinosaur as you can get. It's my go-to example of a transitional fossil for that reason.
That's why it's tattooed on my arm.
Yeah. Love it.
So Steve, it's trans.
Yeah, it's absolutely
true. It's a transitional dinosaur.
So does Archaeopteryx also have sort of like the few fingers that are at the end of the wings kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah. It does. And so, you know, a couple of them are kind of fixed for the wing purposes, but one of them is loose, and that's the one it probably was using to climb trees with. It has that combination anatomy. It was land-dwelling, but also flying and probably climbing, and was halfway between a theropod and a bird.
And don't we know that at least some of its feathers were also black? Or is that still contested? But I think there's some pretty good evidence.
We have evidence now of the colors. Yeah. I know because of – I'm not sure about what the color of the Archaeopteryx is without checking, you know, just to update myself. But I know we have –
the original discovery
we found pigments for black, for red, and for blue. Mm-hmm. And so there are some birds where we can say, yeah, look. I mean, this had really good soft tissue preservation, too.
It's very cool.
And this is going to be studied for years. We're just getting started. It had both skin and feathers, really good soft tissue preservation.
Man,
so,
nice.
But it's the proteins that allow them to tell the colors because the proteins are they react to light in such a way we could say this would bestow the color red or whatever.
Yeah, is it too old to have any genetic material?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That sucks, man.
Long gone.
It's rock.
Yeah. It's like 150 million years
old. Yeah, that's a rock.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Kara, what are these chimpanzees doing?
They're so cute. Okay, so I came across a new study, a new publication, that reminded me of an episode of my podcast, Talk Nerdy, that I recorded in 2017. Oh, my God. I'm doing this way too long, you guys. So in 2017, I interviewed a woman named Rebecca Atencia, who is a Spanish a veterinarian and scientist who at the time was the manager and the head veterinarian at Chimpanga, which is a chimp rehab center, a Jane Goodall Institute chimp rehab center in the Congo. And we talked about her experience with orphaned chimpanzees. The model at Chimpanga was that they were open to the forest, so a lot of these chimpanzees didn't have chimpanzee parents. They were, again, orphaned, so they were hand-raised and fed, which means that they weren't quite comfortable going back into the wild, but they also didn't want to keep them captive. So they left them open to the forest with their own choice, whether they wanted to come back for food or for shelter. And one of the things that she told me, which blew my mind back in 2017, was that as their veterinarian, they developed a relationship and these chimps would go out into the wild. They would get injured. They were juveniles. They would be, you know, play fighting and doing whatever. They would get injured and they would come back to her and they would show her their wounds. Offer their wounds to her for healthcare. And at the time, I mean, this is, anecdotal, but it was like incredible to hear about. And you did periodically kind of hear these chatters of different animals like self-medicating, whether we're talking about using substances, psychoactive substances, like the elephants that drink the, marula or just different organisms doing that. We also hear about animals self-medicating sometimes with bugs or tinctures. But in this new study, which was published in Frontiers in Ecological Evolution. The study was called Self-Directed and Pro-Social Wound Care, Snare Removal, and Hygiene Behaviors Amongst the Budongo Chimpanzees. So these researchers looked at two groups of chimpanzees in the Budongo Forest in Uganda over the course of 4 months, the Sonso and the Wibira chimpanzee communities. And they observed a couple interesting findings, and they were like, oh, this is cool. Like, I want to dig deeper into this. What they saw that really blew their minds were individual chimpanzees administering first aid to other chimpanzees.
Wow.
So there had been some examples of chimpanzees doing their own wound care. And there had been some examples of chimpanzees doing kind of like hygiene, like tool-oriented hygiene behaviors. But when these researchers noticed that the chimpanzees were administering first aid to one another, they decided to go back and like comb over all of these observations and document all of the different sort of medical observations that they could make over the 4 month period. And they found some really interesting things. So they found self-directed wound care, like wound licking, leaf dabbing, pressing fingers into wounds, and applying chewed plant material into wounds. They also found self-directed snare removal, and these were human-laid, sadly, like poacher snares or snares for other animals that the chimpanzees found themselves injured by. So they would remove the snares on their own. They also found self-directed hygiene behaviors, which every article I've seen is like, and hygiene, and then they like move on. But in the article, they dig deep into it. They were literally wiping their asses. So they were using leaves to wipe after defecating, and they were also using leaves to clean themselves after sex. So like genital wiping after sex. And then they also found licking, finger pressing, and applying chewed plant material to the wounds of others. So one chimpanzee is injured, another chimpanzee licks their wounds, or they press on their wounds, or they chew up plant material and they make a tincture and they would pat it onto their wounds.
Kara, do they say that they actually discovered like a plant that actually has some medicinal properties?
No, I mean, they have gone back at some of the examples of self-medication and looked for what could be an antimicrobial or antibiotic property within their wounds. But in this study, because it was observational, they can't say, and they're explicit about this, we cannot say if their wounds would have healed faster with or without these behaviors. They might have naturally healed on their own.
Do they prefer some plants over others to use?
They absolutely prefer. They do seem to preferentially choose plants. And historically, you know, there's a good introduction, like all good papers have like a deep literature review. Historically, specific plants have been identified as good candidates for those kinds of things. They also did find one case of pro-social snare removal. So one chimpanzee stuck in the snare and another chimpanzee is helping them to be removed from the snare. And so, you know, not only is this an important finding just because it's like really interesting, but as the authors argue, when we talk about like the the predecessor or like early modern medicine, we often are attributing that to human behavior. But quite possibly before we were even Homo sapiens, our hominid ancestors, were engaging in medicinal practices for wound healing.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, the Neanderthals were intelligent enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we have a pain response. I'm in pain. Something, look, you know, everybody gets a cut or whatever. Of course you're going to go to someone in your tribe and ask for help.
Well, and we know that this happened in hominid species because we have examples of organisms with healed wounds, right? So we know that either they naturally were able to heal those things or they were engaging in some sort of medical care or first aid. But to see this in extant chimpanzees, obviously we know they're good with tools. Obviously we know that they are, we already know that they're self-medicating or I had this anecdotal story of them asking a human being for help with a wound that was, you know, either causing them distress or that they were concerned about. But then you add to it pro-social wound care within a species. We're not talking about bonobos. We're talking about chimpanzees.
And these were unrelated, genetically unrelated chimps, right?
They were within in peer groups. So I don't know if like the one was.
I think
related
one article
to the other.
I read said okay. that at least one of these
at least one example
genetically
yeah.
unrelated chimp.
Yeah,
Kara, didn't they also observe one monkey giving an IV to the other one?
They're not monkeys.
Chimpanzees? Come on, you know where I'm going with this. Just a joke.
Where are you going with
Jay,
that?
I got a better joke.
My God, what's happening in this room?
Kara, have they observed any chimpanzees engaging in medical pseudoscience yet?
Well, we don't know yet if this is pseudoscience, right?
Pseudoscience may be the last human behavior that we don't find a precedent in.
Right, right. Yeah. But we also have to remember that some things that we consider pseudoscience now were precursors to legitimate science right? So even phrenology led to important things. Bloodletting at the time. It was the best we had based on what we know.
You're saying chimps are doing phrenology?
Well, they may be chewing up a plant that actually has no medicinal purpose. Yeah. They don't know, but they're throwing things at the wall to see what sticks, and that's really incredible. I mean, that shows good problem solving.
It probably feels better, if nothing else.
Yeah, like packing a wound
packing
can
a wound
feel
is
better.
Reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It helps with getting secondary infections and everything.
Uh-huh. I mean, lots of animals
keeps it moist.
Lick wounds too. I mean, I guess the licking thing is like
there are antimicrobial like you get antibodies and stuff. Saliva is actually not bad for that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know. But we have better medicine than
we
that.
Have better.
Don't lick your wounds.
We can do better. Yeah, don't lick your wounds. Yeah.
Now we know where Dr. Zaius came from.
So speaking of licking.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Licking wounds of others, you think about dogs who will come, you know, anytime there's any kind of scratch or anything on me, one of our dogs is licking it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like the same behavior. And clearly, an animal that co-evolved with us that, you know, kind of self-domesticated, like we were talking about earlier, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
yeah. And dogs, we know, are social animals, like
very
deeply,
social.
Deeply social animals. Chimpanzees are really complicated, right, because they do have hierarchies, they do have societies. By definition, they are social, but they are also often seen as very conflict-oriented animals. And so, like you mentioned, Steve, if this is an animal that I'm not directly related to or I don't know that I'm directly, and I see you as a potential, I don't know, threat, or I might be fighting with you for food or for resources or for mates, but I see that you're injured and I want to help you, that's like a pretty incredible finding.
Yeah.
Instead of just like, I'm going to let you die, you know?
Well, there's probably a lot of reciprocal altruism, you know?
Yeah, and we see that with grooming behaviors,
apes
too.
And monkeys in general.
And that's the thing. When I saw hygiene behaviors in here and I was like, they only observe like a handful of hygiene behaviors, In the articles, they don't say what those are. And I'm like, well, aren't they constantly grooming each other? And then I recognize, no, they're literally talking about cleaning up after going to the bathroom or after engaging
flossing.
In sex.
Flossing.
Flossing. Yeah, yeah. And that's a pretty incredible hygiene
that's
behavior
unusual.
As well.
Yeah. Jay, have they finally cured baldness?
Well, before we go.
This is like almost a cliche, like
I want to talk to
tabloid
people.
Kind
I
of thing.
I need to talk to people out there.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, if you guys. Bob, your hair is thinning. My hair is thinning. Steve,
no, it's
your
not.
What?
I'm going to put him on blast up
bit.
Here.
Is there any social thing that's happened? You feel self-conscious in any way?
No.
Anything?
Only when I'm walking away from people.
Because I used to have hair like Adam, and I don't anymore.
Jay, don't you dare complain. Stop it. Look at your hair. I can't.
You guys
but look
suck. George. George, help me out here.
Oh, what do you need?
Where can I buy a coat like that? No, but George, I want to know. It's not a coincidence you have that microphone in your hand because I asked Ian to give it to you.
Yes.
And I'm gonna impose on you a little bit to answer a couple of questions.
Sure.
You went through the whole thing. You had a beautiful head of hair.
I did. I had lanyard like hair. It was like sailors would look at me, pining that they could use.
They still do, hair. George.
So, how old were you when it started to go?
I was about 30. I lost about 40 pounds when I was 30 years old. Like consciously really went for it. And it worked. It was great.
Most of it was hair.
So what did it do to you emotionally? Like what was that like?
It was the worst. It really affected me in a huge, I mean, I was dying blonde for a long time. Kind of hide it. And then shorter and shorter and shorter. And then just thought, all right, I'll start shaving it. And my first shave, I still hate it. I hate it.
Yeah.
We've talked about it.
So you,
which is ironic because everyone thinks you look fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, that's all we know. Right. We don't. You know.
I'm just saying. It's just.
We all see something very different in the mirror.
Yeah. We all do. I mean, it's interesting.
Because of this news item, I was doing some research and just reading, and like, there's a massive emotional response to almost everybody.
That's why it's such a common target.
Yeah.
Well, and I experience, and not to interject too much, but when I'm doing therapy with individuals going through chemo, whether we're talking about men or women, even though it's not always temporary, but even though it is often temporary, sometimes the emotional reaction to losing their hair is like more intense than the reaction to having violent emesis or being very, very ill from the chemo. And people will go to these I thought about it. What would I do if when I had cancer, I had to have chemo? I don't think I would cold cap. And cold capping, if you don't know, is you're wearing this freezing cold, helmet thing on your head the whole time you're going through chemo in an effort to try and save some of the follicles. And there's some evidence that shows it works. It's not complete. It's oftentimes people still lose some of their hair. But the violent pain, you're already so sick from the chemo, and it's so uncomfortable to sit there with the cold cap on. But it's worth it to a lot of people because the idea of losing their hair and the idea of going bald during that experience, even temporarily, is so emotionally
My wife
taxing.
just shaved.
That's what I would do too. I want a warm blanket. I want to be able to take baths.
Connection to this, I experienced a variation of this whole scenario. I was using Rogaine foam to just maintain what I had and maybe not lose a little more. And I had an cosmically ironic reaction to it that it caused an area this big, palm of my hand, in the back of my head, to fall out in a month, in 30 days. This was basically gone back there, and I didn't know what it was. My doctor's like, oh, it's male pattern baldness. Well, it didn't seem like it because it doesn't happen in a month. You know, over years is one thing, but in a month, it really affected me. I thought I considered every conceivable way, you name it. I thought about, I'm going to do this, I'll try this, I'll try that, I'll try that. And my realization was just embrace it. People don't notice or care that you're bald, but they will notice that you are trying to hide it. That's the key realization right there. And after a year and a half, 2 years, it grew back. I found out it was alopecia areata. It was some weird immune reaction to it. I didn't know at the time it was ever going to come back, and it mostly came back. But it was like a weird experience.
Yeah, you approached me. You were like,
dude, look at this. Look at this.
What's going on?
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I have this, but I don't know what it's like.
And my stupid doctor.
Sure,
my doctor's like, oh, male pattern
baldness. Your primary care doctor. You should.
He was a putz. I said, all right, fine. Fine, but why is it? Why is what hair is there like white? Why? What's going on with that? You know, I wasn't gray like I am now. And he's like, I don't know, go to a specialist. And the specialist looked at me for 3 seconds. Yeah, alopecia areata.
That's what specialists are for. But also, seriously, it's night and day sometimes. But also, to be fair, physicians have a steady stream of people whose complaint is, I'm getting older. they're having symptoms that are age-related.
I'm not buying it.
And so I'm just saying, yes, there's that 1% where, or 2% or 3%, whatever, where it's something else, and we have to sniff that out. But it's easy sometimes for that to get lost in the background of why aren't I 20 anymore?
No. I'm not buying that.
You can't complain to our doctor.
I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying for context.
If I can't go to my doctor and bitch about what I don't like about being
old. I didn't say that either.
Well, what are you saying, Steve?
I'm just giving you
Can we get back on topic here?
He's from another point of view, Jay.
I got to click back to George.
All right.
Now, I've already pushed you. But I'm going to push you further. Did you try anything really stupid to get your hair back?
No, I investigated everything. I knew everything about hair you need to know. I knew that Rogaine does what Rogaine does, but Rogaine's only for the crown and the back. You know, so there's no point.
Except in my case.
Right. I knew that stuff that was being recommended to me by hair salon people, I knew it was all bunk. I knew it was nonsense. So I didn't invest any money. I think
I did.
Apart from dyeing it blonde just to kind of hide it, I knew that this is where it's at.
Yeah.
But no interest in like a transplant? Because that is a thing, right?
I mean,
that's the only potential.
That's a real thing.
Something that could really make an impact.
Until now.
All right, so I was going to read off a bunch of weird things that people did. There's just a couple here.
We covered some of
them. I mean, it's funny when we, in modern times, you look back, the Egyptians used to make a mixture of dates, donkey hooves, and dog paws, and they'd rub it on their heads. Trying to do anything. You know what I mean? It was all pseudoscience. It was all, people I bet there was a lot of lying and a lot of people spending a lot of money.
Old remedies.
The baldness cures in the Middle Ages. They would boil nettles in vinegar. What are nettles?
It's a plant.
Little parts of plants. Yeah.
And they would use onion juice, salt, and bear grease. Bear grease, right?
I don't want to know.
And today, you thought that was weird. People use urine today to regrow hair. They use cayenne pepper and garlic paste. Now, I know a freaking recipe that would be awesome.
Cayenne pepper, ooh-wee.
But you don't want to put pepper on your head? Anyway, onion juice, cow dung, and banana mixture.
A little bit of onion.
Really.
Onion, cayenne pepper.
Okay,
I remember that commercial.
What's actually happening, and I'm this is the first time I've actually been a little encouraged by anything hair-related. There was a team at UCLA, William Lowry, Heather Chris Volk, and Michael Jung, and they identified a molecule called PP405. And
so there is pee in it.
It's PP405.
Go in the shower treatment.
Yeah, PP therapy. Yeah.
Come on, that was good, Jay. That was good.
It's like an 80s stuff. I'll use PP.
Damn. I hate when I miss the obvious ones.
Come on.
So it's a molecule. I could not find whether or not they found it or made it. I would imagine that they found it. Now, this is not a hormone. This has nothing to do with hormone intervention, right? So the hormone interventions that are out there, you know, Rogaine, Minoxidil, and they come with side effects. And yeah. some people don't get them, and some people get them, and they could be really bad. Like the side effects could be really intense because it messes with your hormone levels. And a lot of the reasons why people go bald is because of hormones. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get older and your hormone levels change and all that, you know, the older I get, the more I'm like, I don't want to mess with my hormones. It's one of those things that I think we should leave alone.
Well, and also don't a lot of the drugs like Propecia and stuff, they sort of prevent future hair loss or slow it. They don't actually make you grow a lot of new
some
hair.
Some can,
but Minoxidil can make you grow
a reasonable back. Expectation is maintenance.
Maintaining what you have. Yeah. So you start it young.
Yes.
Yeah.
The basic info on going bald, we have hair follicles, right? And these hair follicles, it's common. It's totally typical. Everybody's hair goes through a growth cycle and a rest cycle. And when a rest cycle happens, the hair falls out. So as we get older, like I said, we have hormone changes. Stress can also be a factor in this, where what happens is the hair follicles stop reactivating. They just, you know, they take their rest period and then they go on permanent vacation. So the fact is, though, those hair follicles aren't dead. They're getting a blood supply. They're still viable. They just are kind of, they're basically hormonally turned off. And PP405,
PP. Can't say
right
it now.
Right there, Jay. Sometimes you're just too close to it.
I literally have the word urine one paragraph above PP.
He's so mad at himself.
Jay, I got you.
And if you didn't hear the private show today, right, George? Holy shit. Whoever was there, please, it was an adult woman. That's all.
That was great.
Oh,
but
what
Jay,
the hell was
regarding the pee-pee, I got your back. I got your back.
Thanks, Bob. So this chemical, you guys know what the name of it is, the mechanism targets a particular and very specific cellular component known as mitochondrial pyruvate carrier, MPC, and I will refer to MPC in a minute. So they say it's a protein complex that regulates metabolic activity in stem cells, right? So there is a stem cell component to this, which is pretty cool. So the chemical that they're using, it inhibits MPC. It shifts the cell's metabolism in a way that triggers the follicle to re-exit dormancy, which is perfectly normal, right? And it will begin producing terminal hairs. Now, terminal hairs sound like the hair that's about to fall out, but for some reason they picked terminal to mean pigmented, strong, healthy hair, not peach fuzz. So this is like your best hair, right? The best version of the hair that you can
wait,
grow.
Could this reverse gray too?
It says pigmented.
Wow.
So this is a heavy hitter here. They spent a decade developing this one chemical or working with it. Again, I haven't found out if they created
10 years.
It or not. And guess what, guys? And this is the part that blew my mind.
It doesn't work.
They in 2023, they completed the phase one human trials in California, and the participants that applied the topical cream, I think they did it for 1 week before bedtime, and the results were described by researchers as statistically significant. And I want you to realize that statistically significant means good. Like, it's not just, oh, it sounds like it was 50, you know, it was a small percent. No, statistically.
Yeah, but keep, but for context, a phase one trial is a safety trial. It's not an efficacy trial. So it means it probably wasn't blinded and, you know, it wasn't powered to show that there was an actual effect. It just means it was safe.
And statistically significant means it is more likely than chance alone to have that effect.
What was the p-value?
Whoa! I missed all of that.
Jay, we got you, man. That's why we're here.
So wait, so there was more because I was not satisfied with statistically significant. So they said,
what was the effect size?
I went to the study.
How did I miss p-value?
And then I used ChatGPT to read the original study, but I used the research one, which like does a huge analysis and actually does a lot of other checking and everything, and then it gave me a wonderful summary. So what they found was that there were absolute signs of follicle reactivation, which means they were seeing the hair follicles, there was growth happening, and there were no signs of toxicity or follicle damage, which was something that they were like being extraordinarily aware about, because anytime you do this, you know, they want to know, is there side effects? Are we actually damaging the hair follicles? Is there anything entering the bloodstream? They didn't detect any of that, which is good. This is all really, really nice to hear. And on top of that, Steve, phase one. They're in phase 2A now. You know what phase 2A is?
Yeah, it's the one after phase one. So phase two, it's a preliminary. I actually, true story, very quick courtroom drama thing. I was getting sued. I'm in the courtroom, and the other side had a researcher being an expert witness for them, and I knew they knew nothing about clinical medicine. So I told my lawyer, ask him what a phase 3 clinical trial is. And their answer was, it's the one after phase 2.
Awesome.
But anyway, it's a preliminary efficacy.
Was he right?
Trial.
Was he right?
So they're doing it. They're doing it now. They have 60 participants. And this is the part that I knew Kara was going to do a backflip for. They deliberately picked various genders, hair types, and ethnic backgrounds.
They need to, yeah. It can't be a study on white men.
Because everybody goes bald. There's people of all...
Well, and women experience hair loss. Like, a lot of women experience hair. Just because we don't have male pattern baldness necessarily doesn't mean that our hair doesn't thin significantly as we age.
And some women... Especially devastating because they're not supposed to lose their hair.
Right, culturally.
A lot of women do have pattern baldness. Not the same as men, but they wear wigs. You know, so we don't see it. You don't see it as much as you would with a man.
Well, I have a statistic on that. So 50% of men experience some type of pattern hair loss. 25% of women by age 50 experience some type of hair loss. Yeah. Those are not insignificant numbers. And then it goes into they were talking about the psychological distress and everything. I think we covered that. So to give you the overview, phase one trials were completed in 2023. Phase two trials are underway, and they're going to be ending this year. And they have more people and more diversity going on. And then if the phase two results are good, then they're going to move forward into phase three, which is the one that I think is like, that's where
that's
really
the one you need to get FDA approval.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they're saying the best case scenario, if everything goes great and they did find, you know, something that really works, it could be out around 2027. Worst case scenario, 2029. So I'm thinking, like, man, I might actually, like, make the curve.
Yeah.
I think
so, George,
it just might
here's
save
the
me.
Question.
Yeah.
It works. It's safe.
Yeah.
Are you rocking a new head of hair?
No question.
Right?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if it's, again, the problem is something like this, they will literally be able to name their price.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I probably will not be able to afford what it is in the first 10 years of its existence because this is the moon landing. It's like boners and hair. Yeah.
George, go fund me.
Boners they took care of 20 years ago. And that, you know, that is a almost $1 trillion industry in terms of what it was. This
will be the same.
Yeah. This will be the same, if not even bigger.
But there's I don't want to get into the nuances of the way that our very broken healthcare system works, but if it is an FDA, if it becomes an FDA approved pharmaceutical drug, physicians can
prescribe it.
Right?
It's not, but that doesn't mean your insurance company would have to pay for it.
True.
Who owns the patent on it, though? That's the thing. Like,
Well, UCLA is doing it, but you know, who knows where it's going to end up in some pharmaceutical
of course.
Company's catalog.
That's the thing.
But if you can find a physician that deems it medically necessary and that argues for it, there may be a chance that an insurance company will cover it, and then it may be affordable.
So what's the medical necessity?
No, no. What it is you, if your job counts, we all need to get jobs where you need hair, and then we'll be good. All right, one more quick thing, Steve, before we change.
So, like,
if you're comfortable, you don't have to involve yourself in this. But if you're experiencing any hair loss, raise your hand.
Or clap, because this is a podcast.
Okay. Here we go. One big clap. All right, fellow baldies, here we go. There it is.
Which of you that are experiencing...
And that was them hitting their foreheads, by the way.
Which of you, if you're experiencing it, is it make you sad and uncomfortable? Wow. All right, the opposite. Which of you that have some type of baldness don't care and you're cool with it? That's fantastic.
Okay.
There you go. That is
good
fantastic,
for you.
Guys.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah. I don't like it.
What I want to see if all these phase one, two, whatever. I want to see the number one, before and after, the best response anybody had, I want to see before and after. Wouldn't that tell you, if you're going from bald to something that's got some hair, the answer, that's the answer. We would know now.
You want to see an obvious effect.
Yeah, you want a Bosley commercial for this. Yeah. A guy coming out of the pool.
Right.
It's real hair.
I'm not just the president. I'm also
So, George, what's the first hairstyle that you get once you have the full head of hair back? Are you just going to go fucking wild or what?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care. Like, it literally could be anything. It could be a crew cut. It could be, like, tiger stripes. I don't care. It could be a bad haircut. But I wouldn't give... For like a bowl cut.
Yeah. All right, there it is. It's a mullet. Case closed.
Sun in orange mullet.
George, a coxcomb.
But you're so handsome right now.
Someone, George, to me, you are beautiful and handsome, and I love you the way you are.
No. I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. But it's like, I'm like 10 years into no relationship, right? So it's like, obviously I'm an asshole, or like, it's like the no hair thing. And
we know which one it is.
So that's what I'm thinking.
All right. We don't want to burst your bubble there, George.
George, we got to talk after the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right, Bob, what color is this one? What color am I looking at right now?
I have no idea. I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to do my... All right. Let me just start by saying this. I'm going to address that. But I got an opener. And then
go ahead.
Then I'm going to.
All right, Bob,
that.
Give me your opener.
Wait, what are you trying to say? All right,
reject your setup.
Researchers at UC Berkeley and University of Washington have developed a machine called Oz that can kind of hijack a person's visual system to see something that is otherwise unseeable, the color Olo. This, Steve,
yes,
is a representation of the color Olo.
It's not real Olo. It's fake Olo.
It's a representation of the color Olo. If you're listening and not seeing this, it's basically blue-green or teal. If you're a real geek, it's light at a wavelength of 540 nanometers. Well, more like 542, right? Wouldn't you say it's more 542? But make no mistake.
541, 542,
whatever it takes. But make no mistake, that is not Olo. It's not even close to Olo. One way to look at it is the creation of a three-dimensional object as a shadow of a four-dimensional object. So to try to understand that four-dimensional object, scientists will often look at its shadow, a three-dimensional object that is really a shadow of it.
That is not helpful.
I bet it's helpful to some people.
Is this like how when we can't see ultraviolet light, so we make it purple? And then we go, oh, there's a UV light on.
It's kind of like a representation. It's a representation of something that you can't see or imagine, but that helps give you, it's a shadow of the real thing. Mm. It gives you a hint of the real object, an object that you can't appreciate. Mm. And this is just an attempt to do that. So there is no printer conceivable that can print Olo. There is no digital display that can display Olo. It's not a limitation of what's coming into your eyes. It's a limitation within the eyes. The retina itself does not have the evolved hardware to see Olo.
Would a bird be able to see it?
With what?
Birds or other animals. Do you think they would be able to possibly see it?
I think it would be difficult. You would not have trichromatic vision like a human and see it, I don't think.
So it's not a cold drops issue?
It is. Okay. It is. But it's not just specifically. And this is exactly what I'm going to cover. So there are, yet, despite all of this, there are five people that have seen Olo. And that gets us to Oz. This is the device that they created. Of course, the inspiration was The Wizard of Oz. And it was hard to find out exactly what they meant. But in the books, if you had to put on green filters, glasses, to downgrade the utter brilliance of the green color of Oz. The other obvious connection is that if you watch The Wizard of Oz, they go from black and white to color, right? That's another connection. So to better understand this, though, you need to understand photoreceptors to a certain degree to really appreciate this. Photoreceptors are the specialized cells in our retinas, right? We've got the rods and cones. The rods are for low light, but they don't deal with color. It's the cones that produce the color vision for us, but there's three types of cones. There's the short wavelength, there's the medium wavelength, and then there's the long wavelength. So blue, green, red, basically. So there's S cones, M cones, and L cones. Now, so all the million colors, we could all see approximately about a million colors. And those colors come from the activation of two or three of these cones together. They always activate together. The key point here is that they are never stimulated by themselves. It's always either an S and M cone and, oh boy, an M and L cone. It's
the
never,
pee-pee cone.
It's never a pee-pee yeah. cone. It's never a single type of cone. Could I get the next?
Can you stimulate an L and an S, like the two ends but not the middle, the long and the short?
Well, let's take a look at this chart then, shall we, Steve?
Okay.
So what the key takeaway here is that is you've got this overlap. And because you have this overlap, you cannot stimulate one cone type without stimulating at least one other one. So what that means is that you can never purely isolate, if you could see the peak of the M cone there at like 400 and whatever, 50 or 500 whatever nanometers, it could never be stimulated by itself because you're going to always have a little bit of stimulation of the other cones. So when you see a color like, say, green, it's basically attenuated because there's other colors thrown in the mix because the other receptors are being stimulated.
Bob, can I ask a question?
Yeah, please. Please do.
I was under the impression, it's kind of like the LEDs in TV, where like the combination of the three color groups make the color. It fashions the color, right?
Right,
so
exactly.
I thought that was by design, that we want them to be stimulated at, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought that's how we evolved. That right. We want them to be stimulated at the same time because they have to in order to create the color that you're seeing.
Right, right. That's part of it. And that's why we can see so many colors, because there's so much overlap that you're having various amounts of the receptors being stimulated. So you got all the million, literally like a million potential colors that we can see. So the overlap is important, but it also means that you cannot see a pure color, a pure hue, without having some other colors in the mix. And because of that, that color will never be as vivid as possible.
Got it.
Okay? Now, the way that Oz deals with this is that it literally, keeping your head very still, it literally will map these M cones in your retina. It maps them individually. It says, here's an M cone cell, here's an M cone cell, and it finds 1,000 or so of these, and it maps them. It knows exactly where they are, because this is like a fingerprint. Everybody's retina here will have a different distribution of these M cones on their retina. And this machine can actually stimulate every M cone cell, and no other cell is being stimulated.
So Olo is the color of pure M cone stimulation? So,
and that's where Olo comes from, because on the left, S is zero because it's not stimulated. The M is stimulated, so that's a one. And then the L is not stimulated, that's another zero. So 010, O-L-O. That's where Olo, Olo comes from.
Is it, sorry to interject, but like...
No, please do.
From what I understand, color blindness is caused by one or more cone deficiencies. So somebody who's red-green colorblind has either a deficiency, like an anomaly, or a difficulty with like just their L cone, for example. I don't know which cone it is, but with one cone. And then there's deuterobia, and then there's tri. It's like the what are the words?
Yeah, well, dichromatic, monochromatic,
tritanopia. Deuteranopia and protanopia. So, are there not people in the population who can do this because they have deficits in specific cones, but not others?
No, I didn't specifically study color blindness for this talk, but no, I can confidently say that they're not seeing OLO.
I feel like there's got to be people who just don't have one of the types of cones.
But you would have to not have L or S and have only
that's,
M cones.
That's the difference. It has to be just the M cone to be OLO.
Everything would be green then? You would only see green?
Like blue,
this teal.
All right,
various.
Question, Bob.
Yeah.
We have a hell of a lot more of those in our eyes than a thousand.
Right, right. So, yeah, so that imagine you're looking into the retina and you're identifying specific cells that you then stimulate. They can only map out, say, 1,000 or 2,000 of them, but there's 2 million. There's 2 million of them. So they're stimulating a subset of these M cones. So that's what it does, though. What they do is they look at your retina, they say, all right, here's 1,000 M cone receptors, and they stimulate them. So the short and long wavelengths are not stimulated at all. That never happens. No matter what you're looking at anywhere, anywhere, you will never reproduce that because you always have some of the other receptors being stimulated. So it makes any color you see paler than it potentially can be. So what you end up seeing is a blue, green, or a teal that is so ridiculously vivid that you cannot really imagine it. Right now, my big question is: if you've seen it, can you really reimagine it faithfully? And you probably could. So here's some quotes. You're probably wondering, well, what do these people say? These five lucky bastards that saw OLO. What do they say? One person said that it was a profoundly saturated teal. Somebody said it's blue green, but with an unprecedented saturation. Saturation means that it's vivid. It's just like more of that color. Did you know that pink is essentially a light red? We treat it colloquially as another color. It's not technically another color. It's just a pale version of red. Red is a super saturated pink in a sense. So, Kara, you wanted another analogy. Mm-hmm. It's like having somebody look at pink, somebody who has never seen red ever, and saying, here's pink. I want to show you a super saturated version of it called red. Do you think you could extrapolate in your mind what deep red looks like by only knowing pink? You probably couldn't do it justice, right?
But I also wonder, are the five people who saw this color researchers? Are they these researchers?
A couple of them were the researchers themselves.
Only a couple?
No, not all of them.
Because I would think that there would be a percentage of the population who like, yes, this is so cool scientifically, but you show them and they go, it's bluish green.
No. I don't think they had any of that reaction at all.
But were they primed to think this is freaking awesome? You know what I mean? Like, you sound so excited. But I feel like there have got to be people who are like, it's like
no
color.
No,
there are people that watch Star Wars and basically were like, yeah, I saw it. What we learned is they don't get to see the movies anymore, and we're never going to ask them to see OLO. That's it.
Yeah.
I doubt they were as excited as me, but I would bet that the researchers that were very excited.
I'm sure they were very excited.
Even more than me.
I wonder if this would ultimately be leveraged in like virtual reality, where you actually have goggles that are fixed to your head, and they map out your retina, and then they're stimulating your rods and cones with individual lasers.
It's interesting to contemplate.
This is a solution to a problem we didn't have.
Those are the best ones to solve.
I disagree, but I'll give you some other ideas on that, Kara. Let me finish with my favorite quote. Favorite quote. Significantly more vivid than a green laser light. You've all seen laser light. It's like ridiculously vivid. They're saying it made laser light look pale. That's how intense this was. In the future, it could help with color vision research, color blindness treatment, and retina disease modeling. This could be extremely helpful. I want to see this. I don't want to see OLO. I want to see OOL, OOL. I want to see this with red light, a hyper vivid, a hyper saturated red, I think would be a lot more interesting than teal. You know, that's just my opinion. All right. Question for just quick discussion. Is this a new color or is it not a new color? My opinion is this is not a new color. This is blue green. We know blue green. We know teal. This is just a hyper saturated teal that's beyond the mechanisms of our retina, but it's not a new color. Everyone here is saying it's a new color. It is a new color.
I don't think it's a new color. All colors are just different versions of the three colors.
I was going to say, like, more fundamental question, what is a color in terms mm-hmm. of how you divide up this continuum of light? You know, isn't it arbitrary to some degree to say we can see a million colors? Couldn't you divide yeah. that in half again mm-hmm. and now we can see yeah. 2 million colors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are physiological measurements of what is the least noticeable difference. Like that's right. an actual measurement yeah. in physiology.
So that's what
so
that,
it could be that, could yeah, be there's that. A least noticeable difference yeah. between that's a, good point. A million
yeah.
colors.
Right.
All right, let's move on.
Wasn't that cool? I love it.
I know, I hear you. That's why I'm moving on.
Right, here she is.
Who's that?
All right, Evan.
Yeah.
This is Elizabeth Holmes.
Yeah, that's Elizabeth Holmes.
Yes, a nefarious character.
The former chief executive officer of Theranos.
Isn't she in the Huskow? Why is there news related to her?
Yeah, she's in the Huskow. But that's right, she is in the news. So Theranos, we have covered this before on the show. The now defunct health technology company that once soared in valuation. $9 billion, I think, at its crazy peak valuation, however they did that. This was after the company claimed to have revolutionized blood testing by developing methods that could use a very small volume of blood, such as from a finger prick. Whoop, that's it. One little drop of blood, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Figure it all out, right?
Yep, which I instantly knew was bullshit.
Right. Right. It took you about a second to smell that one. So, yeah, she's in jail. Back in early 2022, she was found guilty of defrauding investors out of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oof.
3 counts of wire fraud and 1 count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud for lying to investors about the devices developed by Theranos. She
but no found. Counts of harming patients, right. only investors, because that's what's right. more important. Right?
Not guilty on the four
oh my
other
God.
Fraud charges related
America.
To the allegations yeah. that she duped patients
yeah.
Who received false or faulty results from the tests conducted by Theranos. 11 years in prison, and she has to give back, over the course of her life, if she can, $452 million. She is her quote is, failure is not fraud, and she stands by that still to this day. She believes that she's innocent, that she worked. Everything she did was with correct and good intentions, and it just didn't work, and that's not fraudulent. But she also, exaggerated the accuracy and reliability of the testing technology. She falsely claimed partnerships with pharmaceutical companies and the United States military, and she kind of made up these fake demonstrations and altered lab reports.
Yeah, she straight up used other people's machines and put her logo on it and was like, look, it works.
Right, so I think she needs to go back to school to figure out what the real definition of fraud here is. But the reason she's in the news is because, she's married. Before she went off to jail, she married a person by the name of Billy Evans. Billy Evans is one of the heirs to the Evans Hotel fortune. If people in the San Diego area are familiar with this, apparently it's a family-owned group of hotels. His background is that primarily he was with a company called Luminar Technologies, a company specializing in self-driving car technology. He, this is Elizabeth Holmes' husband, Billy Evans, has founded a new blood testing startup called Hemanthus, 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 which means what? Blood flower, blood. Mm-hmm. Blood lily, I believe, is what it is. The company aims to develop diagnostic technology that analyzes small samples of blood, saliva, or urine using artificial intelligence. And they have so far raised $20 million.
$20 million.
I mean, hold on a second. So you got this woman who the world knows who she is.
Yep.
It was a huge scandal. She gets married.
Yep.
Goes to prison.
Yep.
Her husband basically says, I'm going to make the same thing she did. That's pretty much what's happening here. And people give him money?
This has AI, though.
Now,
with artificial intelligence.
You think the first thing you would do if you're about to hand over, I don't know how many investors there are, but let's say one person gave them $1 million. Would you at least do an internet search on who they are?
I mean,
they have to know. How can you not?
This is a whole thing, but sometimes investors have the FOMO, right? The fear of missing out. And they invest a lot of money knowing that 19 are going to fail, but one is going to hit. And so if they're open with open eyes saying, all right,
rolling the dice.
They're rolling the dice. Yep. That's on them. You know what I mean? As long as they're not being lied to, right? As long as they're not.
Isn't there also I don't know what her settlement or her court outcome was. I mean, clearly they're able to do this. But you often do see in these like fraud cases, you know, some sort of Ponzi scheme banker. It's like, and you are banned from practicing banking. You and your immediate family, you know, but they clearly
didn't. Yeah, but I don't know if this is her husband.
This is her husband.
I don't know if he was included in any kind
of. It should have been. Yeah, it should have been you and your immediate family, but it clearly wasn't.
Her first sentence is she's not allowed to hold a corporate position until like the year 2037 or something.
Yeah.
It is part of.
But it wasn't like no more blood companies in your core.
But again, this is.
I didn't read.
Yeah, clearly not.
Oh my God. To me, it's like, this is the husband of the woman who, you know, had a $9 billion fake company.
Right.
And people are going to throw money. Even with that, Steve, like, I'll just pick one of the other 3,000 venture things that are happening out
there. I'm not defending the decision. Fool me once. Explain it.
Right? Fool me once. Shame on me.
Just trying to put some context in there.
I appreciate it.
You? Fool me twice. Yeah.
The company tweeted the other day, sort of in response to the very question you're asking about, you know, how and why is this happening? And here's what the tweet says. Yes, our CEO, Billy Evans, is Elizabeth Holmes' partner. Skepticism is rational. We must clear a higher bar. We prefer to build first, talk later. The science, when ready, will stand on its own. Does that
hilarious.
Sound like, oh my gosh.
We want peaceful coexistence. It's like, no, you don't. You want to eat us.
Here's the next tweet. This is not Theranos 2.0. Theranos attempted to miniaturize existing tests. Our approach is fundamentally different. We use light to read the complete molecular story in biological fluids, seeing patterns current tests can't detect. Not an improvement, a different paradigm.
I mean,
we've heard before that
superficially, it's fine.
Yeah.
And if it weren't coming from the, you know, the partner of Elizabeth Holmes, would be like, all right, just show me the data, show me the science behind it. But sure, we could use light to see what stuff is made of, and sure, we could use AI to look for patterns. And
that's mass spec.
That's
fine.
That's
already,
superficially, it sounds fine. And maybe we're being too harsh. Maybe this will eventually work out. But at the end of the day, they're right in that the science will speak for itself, both positive and negative.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the way that we have structured startup culture in this country is give us money now, ask questions later.
Yeah.
And so where's the line with fraud? You know what I mean? Like if this is a nothing burger.
That's her point.
Exactly.
She's like, this is the fake it till you make it culture is just inherent. Her point was that this is what everybody does. You're only coming after me because I'm a woman. Right, mm-hmm. That was her point. There may be an element of truth to that, but I do think that she was way over the line to actual fraud.
Yeah.
Not just hype or, you know, doing the thing that they do, you know, like we're like, we have a guy in a costume pretending to be the robot, you know what I mean?
That's
like
everyone different,
does
right?
that. So yeah. why wasn't right. that fraud? Like, why is, you know what I mean? So there's
because
that,
when
that
you finally have a prototype
is,
and your prototype is fake.
Yeah, it's a fake prototype, but it's just a demonstration though, Karen.
Well, exactly. It's always just a demonstration. Because they were already in Walgreens.
I mean, look, guys,
they were already like using consumers.
Apple was doing it. You know, Steve Jobs, when he demoed the first iPhone,
it was fake.
It was on rails at least.
It was like totally on rails and it crashed. Like you know what I mean? Like that almost didn't happen.
But when he sold the first iPhone, he wasn't selling an iPhone on rails.
No, exactly.
That's the difference.
Exactly. He wasn't selling a BlackBerry and putting an iPhone.
A product that didn't work.
They knew they were going to get there, but I don't know. I don't trust this.
And I think the whole conversation about where's the line between a demo and fraud or whatever can just be avoided by just creating a clear demarcation between something that's health related, where the fake it till you make it equals death.
Exactly.
And on this side, the fake it till you make it equals you got a shitty phone.
Right. Yeah. Right. I know.
You know?
Exactly. But which is why it's so interesting to me. And again, but for investors, you could say as long as you're not committing, you're not like doing certain things like lying, outright lying, or misrepresenting to investors or whatever, then it is like buyer beware kind of thing. You're just, it's all a gamble and they're gambling on something. You're saying, I don't have it now. This is just my plan to do this.
Because
that's
do have
fine.
An FDA, right?
But the patients who were harmed by fraudulent actual medical care had no remedy here.
Like if we have ostensibly a Food and Drug Administration that has to approve certain types of devices or certain types of procedures, anything before it receives approval is research.
Is research.
And once it receives approval and it's, you know, open to the public, at that point, you're committing fraud.
All right.
Yeah.
Evan, anything else to wrap this up? Or
yes, here's the wrap-up line. Now, you mentioned the prototype, right? Yeah. The prototype of the machine, the one. This new company also released a photo of their prototype. And according to the NPR article, I'll quote, It looks suspiciously like Theranos' defunct testing machine.
But Evan, this is not Theranos 2.0.
This is not Theranos 2.0, as long as you get that straight.
As long as you keep saying that, you're good.
That's right.
All right. All right. Look at this cute little guy. So this is KJ. This is KJ. He has a genetic disorder. CPS1 deficiency, carbamyl phosphate synthase 1 deficiency. This is a urea cycle disorder. So, you know, we break down proteins into ammonia. Then the ammonia gets converted to urea, and then you pee the urea out, right? That's normal metabolism. This enzyme is what turns ammonia gets ammonia into the urea cycle, right? So it eventually spits out urea. So if this enzyme isn't working, you don't make urea. Ammonia builds up. Ammonia is a toxin. It can damage the brain, it could damage the liver, and it can cause permanent brain damage, and it can cause death. 50% of children born with this disorder die. They don't. So 50% mortality. The ones who survive mainly survive because they get liver transplants. The idea, so you have to keep them alive until they're old enough to get a liver transplant.
What age?
It depends on how fast they grow and how much they thrive, but you know they have to, you know, be like 1-2 years old.
But is that where the problem is? It's in the liver?
It's that enzyme. It's a genetic mutation of that enzyme.
But if they have a new
in the liver. Yeah, it's in the liver. It's in the liver. Yeah. And one of the treatments to keep them alive is you have to reduce their protein intake, which, you know, you kind of need protein to grow. So they're, you know, giving them the least amount of protein we can to have them kind of survive long enough to get a liver transplant. You also have to give them drugs that scavenge the nitrogen, right? That scavenge the ammonia to try to get rid of that as much as possible. It's, you know, it's expensive. It's dodgy. Again, 50% mortality rate. And the thing is, like with an enzyme like that, there could be hundreds of mutations that inactivate that enzyme, right? So it's not one specific genetic mutation. It's just anything which makes that enzyme not work. It could be hundreds of different mutations. All right, so KJ was born with this disease. He has his own unique mutation that is inactivating this enzyme. When he was born, his pediatricians who, you know, had been working with CRISPR and genetic, you know, treatment were like, maybe we can design a CRISPR to treat KJ's specific mutation.
Oh, wow.
But we'd have to do it fast, you know, because he's not going to live that long, or he's not going to live that long without a liver transplant. It took them 6 months to basically make the CRISPR.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
They then gave him 3 infusions of the CRISPR. Remember, CRISPR is a genetic engineering tool. Yeah, and it.
Yep.
Remember what it stands for, Bob?
Shut up.
Clustered.
Clustered.
Repeating.
Palindromic repeats.
Oh, no, not repeating. Clustered.
Interspaced palindromic repeats. Okay.
Oh,
I knew two of the CRISPR. Letters.
CRISPR.
Go ahead.
What's the R?
Keep going.
Okay.
Repeats.
Repeating. Yeah.
So anyway.
First R.
So they did it. They packaged them in these liposomes, right? We talked about that before as well. They got it to the liver. I couldn't find this, but I think the liver has its own venous system, blood supply through the portal system, because it drains the everything you absorb in your gut goes to your liver first, so the liver can detoxify it. So, but anyway, they got it to the liver. They did it 3 times over, like, from February to April of this year, and basically to try to fix this mutation in as many of the liver cells as possible, and it freaking worked.
Wow.
Now, it's not 100% cure because it didn't fix every cell, but it did enough that, at least so far, he is able to eat more protein, so he's growing better, he's thriving, and they were able to cut the dose of his medication in half. Mm-hmm. And so his probability, I don't know if this is going to be enough to keep him from getting a liver transplant or if it'll just really maximize his chance of surviving long enough to get one. And again, this was the first treatment. This is the first one.
And it was only 3 infusions. Like, he could get more infusions.
He can get more infusions. Yeah, yeah. Right. Keep doing it until you get enough of those cells.
They didn't give the parents a bill for $30 million, did they?
The parents agreed to do it. And of course, this is research, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, this is a milestone.
Yeah,
right. Amazing. This is a milestone, just like the first IVF baby was a milestone. This is the first time we've done bespoke genetic therapy to treat a genetic disorder. Yeah. And we did it again. We was done within a time frame
in
that
vitro.
Could work therapeutically.
For one kid, I mean, there might not be any other kid that has that specific.
No, they'll have to engineer it for each person.
And it's not just it's not just the first time we've done a bespoke version. It's the first time we've done it in vivo, in a living child, not in utero.
So
that's
this
huge.
Is a game changer. Yeah. This is opening the door to potentially treating any genetic disease. This is an absolute game changer. I think we will look back on this one case as like the seminal case, the first case in this.
But this had a good vector though, right? I mean, that's not all these diseases
but the thing
have
is,
good vectors.
You're right, but the liposome, you're right. I don't know if this would work in the brain, for example, but this is the vector technology. So you have like the CRISPR is the genetic engineering technology. The vector is how you get it to the cells you need to get it to. With the FDA approved treatments, thalassemia and sickle cell, we take the cells out and then we do it, in vitro. This is doing it in vivo, in a living organism. Yeah. And again, it depends on where in the body it is. And as I said, the liver is kind of convenient to get access to. But still, this is an absolute game changer. We had the vector worked, the CRISPR worked,
amazing.
The targeting worked. And it improved this child's life and their chance of success.
And whether they do it in the body or they take the cells out, CRISPR them, and then reinfuse them doesn't really, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't matter. Like CAR T cell therapy, we're doing these things outside. It doesn't matter. You're still reinfusing these things into the body.
Whatever works for whatever specific thing you're trying to treat. Yeah, anyway, we had to talk about this.
Yeah,
this is an absolute game changer. Let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you guys can play too. All right, but first we're going to ask the rogues to give their answers, then we'll see how the audience voted. Are you guys ready? So there's the theme. The theme, because we had to prep four shows in basically 8 days. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do all news items. All right, here's the theme. The theme is dwarf planets.
Ooh.
Ooh. Here we go. Dwarf planets are cool. Number one, the most massive dwarf planet is Pluto, about 27% more than the next most massive, Eris. Item number two, Haumea is the fastest rotating planet or dwarf planet in the solar system, resulting in an equatorial diameter about twice as long as its polar diameter. And item number three, of the five official dwarf planets, four have one or more moons, while one has a ring. Okay, Adam, as our guest, you get the privilege of going first.
I was so quiet. I didn't make a single sound.
You did very well.
God, okay.
It works sometimes.
You know.
All right. Okay, so the last one, number three, one of the five official dwarf planets, of the five official dwarf planets, four have one or more moons, while one has a ring. That sounds very familiar. That sounds, I don't see why that couldn't be possible. The middle one, I have no idea. I'm so completely confused on what this means at all. And the first one.
So I'll tell you what it means. Okay. So Haumea is one of the dwarf planets. So it's spinning so fast that it's squashed, right? So that the equatorial diameter is twice the polar diameter.
So like an oblate spheroid.
Really oblate. It's like
polar diameter being
like the North Pole, the South Pole
smushed.
Is
oh,
half
from
the
top
distance
to bottom. Gotcha.
Of the equatorial diameter. So it's like, twice as wide as it is high.
It's short and fat.
Yeah.
It's a chode. Okay. That seems like a pretty crazy fast rotation. Almost too much to be possible, but the top one seems so familiar, and it seems familiar in the way that makes me feel like the opposite is true. Like it's, I don't know, one seems like fiction to me. I think I've heard that it is absolutely not the largest dwarf planet. It just happened to be the first one that we categorized that way after we started to find other things in the Kuiper Belt and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say number one is fiction.
The Pluto being the most massive dwarf planet.
Correct.
All right, we're going to skip over to Evan. Because I am the lord of science or fiction.
It's one, two, or three. There's no letters here.
I don't recall Pluto's relative size to the other ones. it may be bigger. I don't know if it's 27% more. So that one could be the fiction. Also, Haumea, it's the fastest rotating planet. I've never heard that before. I have a feeling that one will be science. And five dwarf planets, four have one or more moons, while one has a ring. I don't remember a ring. One had a ring? I don't recall that being the case. Doesn't mean it's not right, but I'll say the one dwarf planet with a ring, that's the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Yeah, so the thing that I'm noticing is that you're saying Pluto is the most massive dwarf planet, not the largest, right? And I think that's an important distinction. I don't know if Pluto's the largest in terms of size, but it may be the densest, right, or the most massive. So that one might still be true, even though it's not true if you read it, like, quickly. So Haumea being so, like, spinning so quickly that it squished it, would it squish it in that direction, or would it squish it in this direction if it was spinning really, or sorry, so fast? Squish it this way? Something spinning fast? Or squish it this way? I'm not good at physics.
I know, but I can't tell you.
It says equatorial.
No, I know. I'm saying, but would that happen if it was spinning really fast? Oh, would it flatten into a pancake, or would it? I mean, yeah, probably. It's like a spirally like a thing. Yeah. But that would have to happen after it formed, that it would be squished, right? Unless it's spinning while it was forming and congealing. That's not the right word. Aggregating. I don't know. So five official. I don't even know if there are five official dwarf planets, four with, so moons on dwarf planets. Moons on dwarf planets. Or are they moons of other moons? Maybe it's the moon thing that's getting me. Could they be moons of other moons? I think I'm going to go with Evan and say this one is the fiction, because there are so many details in that one that could be wrong.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, the second one about Haumea, I mean, I'm fairly confident that that one is science. I mean, I was definitely remember reading about this, something like this happening, and I'm just gonna say that was what I was reading. The one about we have five official dwarf planets, right? So one of them being Pluto, four have one or more moons, okay, and while one has a ring. Now, to be specific, Steve, you're talking about the dwarf planet has a ring, not one of the moons.
Yeah. Yes. One of the five dwarf planets has a ring.
I have absolutely no reason to doubt that a dwarf planet could have a ring. I mean, at one point, I think our moon had a ring. Hey, slow down there.
Hi-yo.
Jay, hurry up. We got 10 minutes.
Yeah, I think number one is fiction.
All right, Bob, go ahead.
Oh, man, I'm embarrassed. I haven't really looked at dwarf planets in so long. I focused, like, on deep space and not that close, so it's like, crap.
All right, whatever.
Whatever. Just setting the stage here,
hey,
Steve. So for me,
just lowering the expectations.
Yes,
a little bit.
Got to do it in this case, you bastard. Number one here with Pluto, it sounds right. I forget some of the later discoveries, though. I could be wrong on that, but that sounds pretty good. For the third one, dwarf planets having moons and a ring kind of rings a bell. So that could work. The one that just struck me viscerally was the second one. I think a rocky planet spinning that fast and making it so that it's twice the equatorial diameter is twice the polar diameter. That's a hell of a spin, of a rotation there, to make such a dramatic oblate shape there. So that one's rubbing me a little bit. I mean, I'm not very, very confident here, so it's annoying the hell out of me. But I'm going to say that one, number two there, is the
Haumea spinning is the fiction.
Yeah, is the fiction.
All right, so good. So we have a good spread.
Yeah, yeah.
So the rogues were not very helpful to all of you.
What did you pick?
I picked
Haumea? You picked
Pluto. So Pluto, Haumea, and then you picked Pluto.
No, it's Pluto, Haumea, and then we picked... Moons and Rings.
Moons and Rings, Pluto, Haumea. Yeah. All right. So we're going to do the George Traub single clap method. George, you want to do it or do you want me to just do it? All right. I'll do it. So in the audience, if you think that number one about Pluto being the most massive dwarf planet is the fiction, clap. If you think that Haumea spinning fast is the fiction, clap. Yeah. Wow. And if you think that the moons and ring one is the fiction, clap. So I'm hearing 2-1, then 3.
That's right.
Mm. 2-1, and then 3.
You,
all right.
You sound happy with that.
So let's... we'll start with one that got the least amount of votes, number 3.
Okay.
Of the 5 official dwarf planets, 4 have 1 or more moons, while 1 has a ring. Evan and Kara think this one is the fiction. A minority of the audience thinks this one is the fiction. And this one is science.
Yeah.
This is science.
Cool.
So Pluto has 5 moons.
Wow.
Yeah, 5.
Haumea has 2 moons.
Snow moon.
Eris and Makemake have 1 moon.
Each, or they share
each.
A moon? Okay.
And Ceres, covalent which is moon. The only one, only dwarf planet that's in the inner solar system, right? It's in the asteroid belt. Mm. It is not a trans-Neptunian Plutoid dwarf planet.
Plutoid?
Has no moons, right? So 4 have moons. 1 has a ring. Haumea has a ring.
That's cool. Yeah.
That might be telling well, of...
Yeah.
This may be related to other things happening there. Let's go back to number 2. Haumea is the fastest rotating planet or a dwarf planet in the solar system, resulting in an equatorial diameter about twice as long as its polar diameter. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. The clear majority of the audience thinks this one is the
and
fiction.
Stop smiling, bastard.
Und, that is Haumea.
What the hell? And that's rotating like...
That is Haumea. So you're the upper left-hand picture. So this is science. This is science. The upper left-hand picture here is an edge-on view, like an equatorial view of Haumea. Look at that thing.
That's nuts.
Really squashed.
How could I not see that before?
The second picture is a polar view. My question is, and I could not find an answer to this question, so if there's an astronomer who can answer, let me know. Why is that not circular from the polar? Why is it also ovoid in that direction?
Because it's all screwed up. Something's pulling on it.
Now, what's interesting is every single site I went to described Haumea as either egg-shaped or oval. Mm-hmm. But it's not egg-shaped. It's not. It's a flattened egg, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know why it's not just a flattened sphere. I don't know why it's a flattened egg, but it is.
It might have mass anomalies.
Yeah, there could be. It's got to be some other kind of material.
Some
anomaly.
Density anomalies within the crust.
Yeah,
or the mantle probably.
But it's spinning super fast. 4 hours. That's with one rotation every 4 hours, which is fast for something that big.
What's the long diameter? Do you remember?
I think it's like 2,000 kilometers or 1,000 kilometers, something like that, about that.
All right.
Okay.
Which means
that... The most massive dwarf planet is Pluto, about 27% more than the next most massive Eris, is the fiction. So
yeah,
congratulations,
man.
Jay and Adam.
Nice.
I'm the smartest man alive.
Good get, man.
All right.
He has a perfect record.
Kara, you hit upon the magic word.
Yeah, but
massive,
backward.
But you got it backwards.
Yeah, damn it.
So Pluto is the largest
thinking. That's what I was
thinking. But it's not the most massive. Mm-hmm. The most massive is Eris, which is 20% more massive than Pluto. But it's a little smaller because Eris is a lot denser than Pluto. So sometimes these turn on one key technical word. And you did hit upon that, so congratulations.
I attribute this win and me and Adam both winning to the fact that we're both bass players.
I thought it was because you're both Star Wars fans.
And Star Wars fans.
Yeah, you have both those things going for
both
you.
Those reasons are valid, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just really sick of being right for the wrong reasons and wrong for the right reasons
that's
on this show.
That's your existence, Kara.
Yeah,
you have
that's
the best
skill.
Record almost every year, though.
That's your mojo.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Evan, give us a quote.
The true function of reason is not to find beliefs, but to eliminate false ones. Julian Baggini.
Who is that?
English philosopher, journalist, author of 20 books about philosophy written for general audiences. He's written extensively on philosophy and books on atheism, secularism, and the nature of national identity.
Is he alive today?
I'm sorry?
You alive today?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He's a patron of the Humanists UK and organization promoting secular humanism. So, Julian Baggini.
I like it. That's true.
Like it too.
That's what science is all about. It's eliminating the false stuff, not proving yourself right. All right. Well, thank you guys all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, thank you all
thank
for
you,
coming.
Sir.
Good job.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.